welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and it is Saturday, September 3rd. It's a beautiful day in downtown Waukesha. Here at the WAUK Radio, the Shaw in Waukesha, 540 AM, 101 FM. This is Morning Cannolis, a weekend review of the important stories in law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you so much for joining me this morning. We have a program this morning, 2 full hours of exceptional broadcasting this morning from WAUK Radio. It is Labor Day 2022, and we're going to spend most of the hour this morning and the second hour beginning at about 10 o'clock talking about labor, talking about issues important to our labor force in America, important to all of us in America as we enjoy this weekend and also are thoughtful about its history. I'm here in the studios. Calvin is my producer this morning. Calvin, during the course of the 2 hours when we're together this morning, is also going to be shielding and negotiating with phone calls as they come in. So feel free to call me as well. It's 844-967-2789. That number once again, 844-967-2789. Listeners, always welcome to call in and offer comments and questions. This morning, again, talking about labor in America here on Morning Cannolis. Our syllabus is, as always, ambitious but achievable. Very proud to say, pleased to say that in the second portion of our first hour here this morning, Don Brown, who you just heard on the broadcast here this week in Waukesha, is going to be joining me to talk about his labor on behalf of the people of the city of Waukesha, and on behalf of the people of the state of Wisconsin, the entire nation, his time as an alderman here in Waukesha. We're going to talk about some of the history that he has had here, some of his focus on things important to him and to all of us, and then also a chat about some contemporary issues, at least one related to the recent history of Waukesha. All of that coming up in our second half hour this morning. Before we get to that, however, before Don comes over from the farmer's market and joins me for that discussion about labor from the perspective not only of a lifelong resident of the city of Waukesha, but also former alderman, let's chat about Labor Day, where it came from. A bit of a departure this morning. Normally, I spend the first few moments talking about the important events in history, local history, state history, national history, and world history that happened on the particular day that we are broadcasting this morning. Again, Saturday, September 3rd, going to abandon that approach a bit to talk instead about Labor Day. Where did it come from? What are its genesis elements? So where did it derive from? How did this happen in America that we now have a full federal holiday in the United States of America, now a weekend in which we observe Labor Day, often a time of rest and relaxation of family gatherings, but also a time of great history and recollection about where we came from and the dramatic, important contributions that the labor forces of our nation have made to our life, our livelihoods. Where did Labor Day come from? Well, beginning way back in the late 19th century, a time when trade unions and labor movements were growing, there were some diverse groups of trade unionists who were beginning to choose some dates in which to celebrate who they are, what labor is all about. In the United States here, a September holiday called Labor Day was first proposed in the early 1880s, when we first began to hear about this in a sort of an organized way. Now, true to most history, there are alternative counts of the event's origins, and I'm going to give you both of those, and you can pick and choose depending upon your particular historical perspective on this. Descendants of two men with very similar last names claim that they were the true fathers of the holiday, and let me tell you about the first of those stories and then the second of those right after that. According to one early history of Labor Day, the event originated in connection with something called a General Assembly of the Knights of Labor. That's Knights, K-N-I-G-H-T-S, of Labor, the Knights of Labor. They were getting together in New York City in September of 1882. And in connection with, as a part of this sort of clandestine assembly at that time, a public parade of various labor organizations was held on September 5th. And it was under the auspices, under the direction, the control, the authorization, if people of something called the Central Labor Union. The Central Labor Union, the CLU, that was a group that was organized in New York. And the secretary of the CLU, here is the first name. His name is Matthew McGuire, M-A-G-U-I-R-E, Matthew McGuire. He was credited for the most part for proposing that a national holiday recognizing, celebrating labor in America be established and that it be held on the first Monday of each September. And that was one of the origin stories. Matthew McGuire, and again, in 1882, when the Knights of Labor are convening, this fellow proposes that we have a national holiday recognizing labor. Now, there's another story also involving a McGuire, a little bit different spelling, but perhaps the same pronunciation. His name was Peter McGuire, M-C, capital G-U-I-R-E. Again, Matthew McGuire, M-A-G-U-I-R-E. Peter McGuire, M-C, G-U-I-R-E. Peter McGuire was a vice president of something called the American Federation of Labor, leader of the American Federation of Labor. And after a visit to Toronto in Canada, he came back and he remembered that he saw all sorts of parades there that were celebrating labor. And that happened in May. And he put forward this proposal in the spring of that same year of 1882. And according to this McGuire, the Peter McGuire, on May 8th in particular of 1882, he made a proposition to the Central Labor Union. Again, the same entity we talked about in connection with the other McGuire, Matthew McGuire. He made this proposal, according to this history, in New York City, that a day be set aside for what he called a general holiday for the laboring classes. That's how Peter McGuire described his proposal at that time to this major organization, the Central Labor Union, meeting in New York City. And according to McGuire, he also recommended that the event should begin with a street parade common to what he saw in Toronto, common to what was developing throughout the United States of America in various venues, places around our nation. And that was supposed to be a public demonstration of the organized labor's solidarity, its strength, its import. And with the march would be followed by a picnic of some kind, a time for families, which is a tradition, of course, that continues to this day and to 2022. And the notion was at the time that labor unions would use this event, this special day, recognizing the laboring classes as a fundraiser, selling tickets to it in a way of elaborating and on the story about labor, but also ensuring that their coffers were filled to promote the good things that labor organizations, including this Central Labor Union, was doing at the time. He McGuire, M-C, G-U-I-R-E, first suggested that the first Monday in September would be an ideal date for that public celebration. Why? He was looking outside. He said, well, it's optimum weather, and placed on that place in the calendar is about midway between the 4th of July and the Thanksgiving. Public holidays are really established at that time. So he said, you know, this would be a good time. Summer coming to an end, summer between 4th of July and Thanksgiving. First Monday in September, again, very much parallel to what Matthew McGuire in this alternative history had also talked about, was advocating for at the time. And it was common. It was common way back then in the late 19th century, 1882 and going forward, and even before then, that those picnics and public gatherings featured speakers by prominent labor leaders, and again, families gathering together a day, perhaps of rest, but specifically to, again, promote this notion that labor is what makes America great and that keeps us strong. And in 1909, the American Federation of Labor, the convention that was assembled at that time, did in fact designate the Sunday preceding Labor Day as Labor Sunday. And it was dedicated to the spiritual and educational aspects of the entire labor movement. So you had a bit of a religious aspect to this as well, celebrating something called the Labor Sunday in advance of Labor Day itself. Again, a time of focusing on all of that. And this secondary date sort of failed to gain a lot of significant traction at the time, although many churches, many other places of worship, and many diverse religions, temples and synagogues and gurdwaras and other places where people come together to worship, often do to this day recognize, as they will tomorrow, Sunday of 2022, the 4th of September, that Labor Day is a significant event in the history of our nation, including that
that of the spiritual community. Well, the popularity of this event spread across the country, even though it wasn't yet acknowledged very formally by the government. In 1887, for example, the state of Oregon became the first state in the country to make Labor Day an official public holiday. A public holiday in 1887, Oregon is the first state that does it. And then by 1894 or so, about 30 United States were by that time celebrating Labor Day in some way, many of them with very elaborate celebrations, others less so. But 1894, something over half of the, about 30 states or so at that time were celebrating this important holiday. Congress in that same year, 1894, passes a bill recognizing the first Monday of September as Labor Day and making it an official federal holiday. That happens in 1894 after, again, this advocacy with sort of this dual, separate and, if you will, dueling histories about where this came from in 1882. Grover Cleveland, who was the president at that time, signed the bill into law on June 28th of 1894. The federal law at that time, signed by President Cleveland at the time, only made it a holiday for federal workers. And as late as 1930s, unions were encouraging workers to strike to make sure they got the day off. And eventually, virtually all states, including the District of Columbia and the United States territories, have subsequently made Labor Day a statutory holiday. And so the efforts of the labor unions and the labor efforts and the leadership going way back to 1882, before that and after that, were successful ultimately in identifying this important day, Labor Day, which we're celebrating this weekend here in the state of Wisconsin, towns, cities, villages, and glad to have you celebrating with me on this bright and sunny Saturday morning, September 3rd, 2022. A footnote to that, and that is that Labor Day is distinct from what's sometimes called May Day. Also, May 1, it was also known as International Workers' Day, often known as Law Day as well. It's a different celebration, also acknowledging and the significance of workers worldwide, again, usually May 1, which we also recognize here in the United States of America. Come back right after this first break. We're going to chat more about Labor Day and some very recent history that is coming out of our nation's news media just this past week regarding labor in America. This is Morning Cannolis. Stay with us here at WAK Radio, The Shaw in downtown Waukesha. This is Jim Santel. It's Morning Cannolis. Thanks again so much for joining me here in the studio at WAUK Radio. I am joined by producer Calvin, who is working with me to ensure that your calls and your comments are part of our program this morning as well. It is Labor Day weekend. Monday is going to be Labor Day itself. And as I said right before the break, we have got a rich and important history here in America that resulted in the official recognition by the Congress, by the president, and by all of us as an important day on Monday, Labor Day 2022. Going way back to 1882, these different alternative histories for where this came from, but they came together in the end, and a recognition once again, as was initially called, a general holiday for the laboring classes, who recognize to this day, premised upon that early work of the leadership way back then, acknowledging and promoting the importance of labor in our nation. Labor, as all of you well know, continues to be the backbone of America and keeps us strong, keeps us alive. Just this past week, just yesterday, as a matter of fact, some important news coming out of the Federal Reserve about labor in America. Lots of issues recently in our national attention, in our national discussion about labor. And just yesterday, the Federal Reserve announced some significant information about where we are with jobs, how things look economically, and what labor is all about in America, plainly indicating that job growth slowed in August, but still remained fairly strong. And that's
got the Fed, if you will, sort of walking a tightrope, as some of the leadership there and the Fed chair has said. They plainly want to cool off a labor market that some saw as perhaps too hot, with too many jobs and not enough workers to fill them. On the other hand, if they go too far, they could undo some of the progress of the past 2 years and leave millions of people without work. So again, this debate and this economic analysis inside the Fed to make decisions premised upon the best interests of all of us economically. So what was that government data that was released just yesterday? It suggests the Fed actually has managed to maintain that balance pretty well. It has raised interest rates over this past year, as you know, and though its work is plainly far from done. So what was the specific information that was released by the Fed in this past week, just yesterday? We know now, again, Labor Day coming up on Monday, we know that employers added 315,000 jobs last month. That, of course, would be the month of August. And that was a substantial slowdown, as I indicated, from the more than 500,000 jobs added in July. But still, most people say a pretty solid number here in America. The labor force grew by more than 750,000 people, which should ease concerns about a shortage of workers, even while wage growth cooled. All that coming out of the Fed just yesterday. The representatives of Wells Fargo said, overall, there's a lot of to like if you're a Fed official right now. Hiring remains robust, but on a more sustainable basis. And so a lot of the response to that is fairly strong, although, again, not nearly as strong as some of the reports were earlier in this year, February of this year, 2022, well in excess of 600,000 jobs created in that month alone, teetering somewhere around 2,000, 3,000, 400,000 jobs for most of recent times, going way back to August of 2021. Kind of a low in June, as I indicated, back up in July and a bit down in August at 315,000 jobs. So what does the president say? What does the president say about this report coming out just yesterday in advance of Labor Day 2022? This is what President Joe Biden said yesterday. He said, jobs are up, wages are up, people are back to work. And we're seeing some signs, he went on to say, that inflation may be, I'm not overpromising, that's our president describing with some sort of tepid optimism. He said, maybe beginning to ease. He said, coupled with falling gas prices, America has some really good news going into the Labor Day weekend. We know as well, according to the reports, the information released by the Fed just yesterday, that the unemployment rate edged up in August at about 3.7%. It was at a five-decade low of about 3.5% in July, which again is a very low unemployment rate in our nation's history. Most observers and economic gurus say that increase was partly a result of more people reentering the labor force, looking for work. But it also probably reflected, according to the Fed, a modest rise in the number of people losing their jobs as well. And so all of that, again, being monitored very closely. Economists, again, responding to this news just yesterday as we go into Labor Day of 2022. A lot of economists are warning that a cool down in the labor market will mean less bargaining power for employees, particularly those in the bottom rungs of the career ladder. Also going on to say many economists' wage growth soared last year for people working in restaurants and hotels and other service areas, but those gains have also slowed significantly. And very importantly, the unemployment rate for black workers rose sharply in August, just last month, to 6.4%, and that was double the rate for white workers, double the rate for white workers among black workers here in the United States of America. Again, a lot of work to do there in terms of racial equity and ensuring that all of us, regardless of race, background, history, and other immutable characteristics, can enjoy the fruits of labor as we recognize and celebrate this weekend, Labor Day of 2022. In the second hour this morning, in our second hour of Morning Cannolis, we're going to go back to some of those historical issues and chat about two, three, four, maybe even five major cases that the United States Supreme Court has issued in recent years having to do with labor. We're going to look specifically to the role of labor unions and this important connection between paying fees and dues for admission into and membership in labor. So Supreme Court has said a lot about that, including a case not too long ago, just a couple of years ago, involving a labor union and the obligations of non-union members to pay dues. That's a case that is going to be discussed in our second hour called Janus, and we're going to talk about that at some length because it is important, even on this Labor Day of 2022. Then we're also going to talk about the other side of labor, much related to that, and that is employment cases. We've got a number of different employment cases we're going to be chatting about, including a case called Bostock versus Clayton County just a couple of years ago, having to do with the extent to which Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 protects employees against discrimination because they're gay or transgender, the LGBT community, and the decision there in Bostock to acknowledge that the word sex, as it appears in the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, does in fact provide protections for people in the employment setting based upon the Supreme Court's interpretation understanding. So some very important Supreme Court cases. We're going to chat about those in our second hour toward the end of our time together this morning. But before we do that, after the break, I'm going to welcome back to the studios here after his morning over at the Farmers Market. Don Brown's going to be joining us to talk about labor, talk about his history and the important work that he has done here in Waukesha on behalf of all of us. Continue to join us. Stay with us here on Morning Cannolis, WAUK Radio, 540 AM, 101 FM. And we're back. This is Morning Cannolis. It is Saturday, September 3rd, 2022. Thank you so much for joining me. Continuing our discussion this morning about all things labor, including some history about where Labor Day comes from in our first half an hour, and then a little bit of insight into the recent announcements by the Fed about our labor situation here in the United States of America. Some fairly decent news about the number of jobs created in the month of August. Not as high as it has been in past months, but nonetheless a significant comeback, and unemployment for most populations, not all populations, remains at an historic lows. We still have to do lots of things when it comes to ensuring that unemployment in our communities of color likewise is reduced to levels that it is among whites in America. And so we're chatting all morning today about labor. And as I said, the end of our second hour, we're going to be talking about some recent Supreme Court cases, not surprisingly, here on Morning Cannolis, which we spend a lot of time talking about, some cases involving labor unions and the capacity that unions have to require that members and non-members pay dues. And what has the Supreme Court said about that issue? Also chatting about some discrimination cases and the extent to which our discrimination statutes extend to all Americans beyond just those who may have been contemplated to provide coverage under the Civil Rights Act of 1964 when it was first enacted. We're going to chat about that in our second hour. Right now, I am thrilled, honored to have joining me here at WAUK Studios, hot off his time at right down the street here at the Farmers Market this week in Waukesha, my good friend, my partner here at WAUK, Don Brown. Don, welcome to Morning Cannolis.
Hey, Jim, thanks for having me, and very glad to be back in the official office of former Alderman Don Paul Brown, also known as the Walk Radio Studio. So
let's talk about that right from the start. We are sitting in the studios right in Wisconsin Avenue. A good way to get into our discussion this morning. This was in fact your office. Is that correct? This is your trappings right here.
Well, yes, and it's more of a play on words. Okay. It wasn't actually my official office, but in light of the national politics where the former president has his office at Mar-a-Lago. And I used to make a joke that our studios here were the Mar-a-Lago of the Midwest. But that was not subscribed to any political affiliation, but just in a similar, you know, we were both exiles. You know, as many know, I lost my district because of redistricting. And so when I was approached by Mike Crudy for this opportunity to do my show, I thought it'd be a lot of fun, since people knew me as an alderman, to kind of poke fun at that and to let them know that I'm still active in the community and still try to position myself as a community leader the best that I can.
Absolutely. I'm going to spend some time again. Don, thanks so much for joining me this morning. I'm going to chat a lot about you morning.
All right.
And again, a former alder from December of 2020 until April of this year, correct? Right?
So it was actually from May of 2019.
Right. The first term, right? Exactly. Yep. And we're going to chat more about some of the things that were important to you at that time. I'm going to talk about your family first.
Sure.
We're going to talk about a little bit of that, because I know you've got some wonderful members of your family. Spouse Melissa, and you and she have raised four children, correct?
Right? That's correct. And right? Melissa's also, I community leader. She is the director of instruction at La Casa de Esperanza's school, their charter school, after serving over 20 years at the United Community Center, the Bruce Guadalupe Community Schools. She is also president of the Waukesha South Booster Club. And, throughout our time together, has done a great job in leadership and volunteer capacities. And, of course, number one is as a wife and a mother. We dropped off our oldest, her firstborn, Jordan, at lacrosse yesterday.
Right,
and
right.
It was obviously very emotional for her, but I hope that she understands the pride she must feel for all of our remarkable children, but in particular, our oldest, Jordan. She's been a great role model for the younger siblings, and she's living her dream.
Right.
Her number one school is lacrosse.
Right.
National Honor student in National Honor Society student in high school, and was on the varsity dance team since her freshman year. And we just cannot be prouder of the life that she's living. And that's just a big reflection, especially on her mother.
Not a bit surprising, coming from this terrific family that you and Melissa have created together. We know, as you just indicated, not only a laboring to establish this wonderful family, but also a very important laborer here, right in Waukesha as well. So we acknowledge her on this Labor Day.
Thank
as
you.
as we do you. Your other children, Kiara, seventh grader,
our youngest,
right. And also, obviously, starting school just this past week. Right?
Yep, at Horning Middle School, just right here in our neighborhood in Banting Park. So it's great to have a neighborhood school.
Wonderful.
Close to home,
right.
Walking distance.
Good. Evan, who's a junior, both in the classroom and off the classroom on the football field,
is a great
success.
Yeah, had the walk-off pick, to beat Nathan Hale last week. Last night, not so great. Lost a heartbreaker to Oconomowoc, but that's to be expected in the Classic 8, arguably the toughest conference in the state. And he was, disappointed in himself. He played hard. He had quite a few balls thrown to him last night. Didn't make very many catches, unfortunately. But he played well. He played great defense as always, and was a factor in the one touchdown they scored. He basically kind of ran interference from the split end, cutting across the middle, while the flanker came to the outside and was wide open. And so, everybody does their part. And I couldn't be prouder for Evan. He tries hard, and he's also been a great role model for his baby sister. And then our oldest son, Michael, in his senior year at John Hersey High in Arlington Heights, and
wonderful.
Doing great things. So.
Right. And about all that, including something else that you do on Friday evenings. It just started this season, right? Doing the Waukesha South High School football games, doing the not just the color commentary, but the play-by-play.
Yeah, I do the play-by-play, and I get some help with color from Johnny Watermelon, our ad sales manager here. And, I used to broadcast my daughter's softball games. One of the team moms has there's a product called Mevo, which allows you to set up really nice camera equipment. And then there's a mic. You get a free mic on your cell phone. So I had a lot of fun the last couple of years doing broadcast. And so when this opportunity came to broadcast Waukesha Sports, Waukesha South High School sports. Couldn't be more thrilled, especially since I've known a lot of these boys, the junior class, that's my son's class. Many of those boys have been together since fifth grade, so it's just really been a privilege and an honor to see them grow. And I used to broadcast their games when, you know, parents would volunteer and I was I would do the PA, but I wouldn't just do the normal PA. I'd broadcast the game live, and the refs had to talk to me a few times, like,
right,
yeah, no,
right.
You can't do that. And I'm like, yeah, right. Well, come up here and stop me. But
right.
So it's really been fun to be able to do this on a higher scale. You know, I've heard feedback some family members of the players as far away as Hawaii, to the west, and Delaware to the east have been tuning in to Walk Radio to listen to their brothers and nephews and the like.
It's the wonder and the joy of radio, right? And
you can
have that
I love
impact,
radio.
Right?
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And you have, again, been a major player here at WAK Radio.
Thank you.
All of these things, all these important things, and bring a huge amount to it. So
sure.
I know as well, done a bit of research, you're born in Orchard Park, New York. And then
that's correct. Well, officially born in South Buffalo, Irish enclave.
Okay.
But yeah, grew up in Orchard Park, home of the Bills.
Right. Okay,
founded
very
by
good.
Quakers over 200 years ago.
Sure.
And so a lot of history, and it was a great town. We were there visiting my mother last August, and it's always great to connect with family and to be there. It's a wonder. Like Milwaukee, Western New York is a beautiful place to be in the summertime. Lots to do.
And family then migrated eventually here to Wisconsin and Waukesha in particular.
Well,
tell
all
me about
over.
That,
you know, I'm the youngest of 10.
Right.
And Mom and Dad remained in Orchard Park, and only two siblings, my oldest brother and my fourth oldest brother, live like on either side of where my mom lives. My father passed away last year after a long 90-year run and a great life. Son of immigrants, worked four jobs to pay through college, and really lived the American dream, and you know, got put all his kids through college. Just, you know, amazing legacy he left for us, and so he's, you know, still very much a part of our lives. And
absolutely.
So yeah, oldest and the number four are on either side of my, like, about a block away.
Wonderful.
And then I've got a sister that's I guess we should go in order. My second oldest brother is a doctor in Birmingham, Alabama. And he used to work with the Alabama Sports Medicine Clinic with Dr. James Andrews, the celebrated surgeon. And a sister, Nina. So I came up to Milwaukee from Chicagoland, had a former client had an opportunity with this. And that's what brought me here. And Milwaukee reminded me a lot of Western New York, while the Buffalo area, just, you know, great cost of living, great access to green space, a lot of things you can do for free or much more affordably. And only an hour away from a big city, you know, like Buffalo is to Toronto, Milwaukee is to Chicago. And so I met Melissa here and decided this is where I should make my home. And I love it. And Waukesha has been very good to me, and, you know, had an opportunity to participate in local government. And but yeah, rest of the family. Sister Trish is retired. She got retired at age 48 after a career in healthcare with Baxter. And she floats between Denver and Chicago. Brother Sean's in Dallas. He telecommutes to Bozeman, Montana. And he's also been in the healthcare distribution side of things in an executive role. And who else did I miss here? Sister is a doctor in Richmond, Virginia. And my oldest sister lives up the road in Nina. Her husband got a great opportunity 20 years ago to manufacturing. So he's with the Walker Forge there up in Nina, and they love their life up there.
Also, wonderful people all. Lots of laborers out there, on Labor Day. I'm going to chat more about that with my special guest, John Brown, right after the break. We're going to chat more about his academic background at Michigan State University. And then, Don, I want to talk to you about your commitment, especially to history here in Waukesha, and some recent history that also is a part of your time as an alderman here in Waukesha. Continue to listen in here on Morning Cannolis on WAUK Radio, 540 AM, 101 FM.
Thank you.
Once again, this is Morning Cannolis. It is Saturday, September 3rd. It is Labor Day weekend. We're spending the entire two-hour period saluting labor and the importance of labor in America. My guest right now, my special guest, my colleague, my friend Don Brown, who is here talking not only about his family and, yes, consistent with our theme, the labor force that they have brought throughout the United States of America, including right here in Wisconsin, his wonderful wife, Melissa, and their children, who will be a part of the labor force in the future, doing equally important things, right? I'm sure that they've already contributed a lot, right, to the the overall well-being of their family and their communities beyond themselves. So looking forward to that as well. Don, I wanted to chat more about your background in particular. Michigan State University, class of 1989, and gosh, at least 4 degrees by my count. International relations, urban policy, labor relations, HR management. So a lot of things related
actually
to labor.
Actually 2 degrees, okay, but right. It was my bachelor's. Well, first of all, growing up in New York State, you know, the SUNY system has a lot of great colleges, very affordable. And I had the opportunity to go to Michigan State because a brother in front of me got a full ride to Boston University for football back when they had Division I football. I know many of you know it as the hockey school.
Right.
And then my sister above him, she was a class valedictorian. She had several academic scholarships that afforded us, our family, the opportunity to go to University of Virginia. And so it freed up the I met a college rep from Michigan State that was looking at the time Michigan State was making a bigger commitment to recruiting more out-of-state students, and my guidance counselor connected me with him, and I was interested in studying political science, and he told me all about James Madison College, which is a
terrific,
wonderful residential school there. And
it is, yes.
I was able to dual major in international relations and urban policy problems. And you know, you think Big Ten school, 42,000 students, but my bachelor's degree, there was never more than, we always had about 1,000 students in this residential college. And by the time I was a junior senior, the student teacher ratio was like 12 or in some cases 6 to 1. So it was a really great experience. And then I was also accepted in their School of Labor Relations, which was a big honor to me because that's behind Cornell at the time was considered the best school in the country, the best master's program.
And still
for
is.
Labor relations.
Still has a great relation, reputation, right?
Yeah. So that was a real, and I got to, you know, have some wonderful professors that were playing big roles in HR and in labor relations. Daniel Kruger, who I mentioned, was a leading national arbitrator and mediator.
And those kinds of people do inspire, right? There's no doubt that the work that Professor McGuire has done influenced you and continues to have an impact upon us through you and the work that you did there at Michigan State and beyond. Right now, in addition to all of your roles here at WAUK Radio, father and spouse and community leader, you're also a writer and an
That's
academic
correct.
And also all an intellectual force at Spiritist Writing, right? Blogs
That's
executives,
the company. Yep.
Right?
So we, at the time, I was involved in a dream job with a former client/employer, and we were opening up an international division for a community publisher in Dublin, Ireland. And my family's Irish. I have dual citizenship through my grandparents. My grandfather was in the United Grain Elevators Union in Buffalo, and through my grandfather, I have dual citizenship. So it afforded me great flexibility to work in Ireland and reconnect with some relatives, which was wonderful.
Very important.
But the guy I was working for was selling his partnership in the company at the time. We were going to try to open up a new market in Northern Ireland. It just didn't. The original owner wasn't a big fan of the model, and so seeing the writing on the wall, I had an opportunity to do some freelance writing. And that's how Spiritist Writing was born. It started out as a
terrific.
Few brochures, ended up doing like regular blogs and emails. And for this client, it was a healthcare company down south. The blogs was part of an overall strategy, a big part that helped increase their sales significantly by 17%. So it was gratifying to me to know that, you know, good writing can have a really profound impact on a company's profitability.
Absolutely,
and it gave me the confidence to pursue more opportunities and grow the company. And so I represent the Vinyl Siding Institute, doing blogs for them and case studies and some other trade associations. I manage some online communities, including the Center for Responsible Seafood, which has been an amazing experience. And locally, I get to do grant writing for Ronald McDonald House Charities here
terrific.
In Milwaukee, which is, you know, one of the great causes of my life. I lost a brother to leukemia before I was born, back when the research just wasn't there. And also have a sister that's a survivor of severe depression. And so it's neat to be part of this this mission. And I mentioned my sister because Ronald McDonald opened up a family room last year at Rogers Behavioral Health, and it's only the second in the RMHC global charity system that's partnered with a behavioral health hospital. So really grateful to be part of that that mission.
Absolutely. The power of language, right? Not just
sure
spoken
is, yep.
word that you and I are engaging in right now. You do so much here at WAK Radio and beyond that in the city of Waukesha, but also the written word, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Language is important. Teaching language, communicating well, all those kinds of things coming out of your education, again, way back in New York and through Michigan State University and right here in Wisconsin since then. So good for you to do all of that. A lot of that
Thank
ability
you.
To communicate, Don, not only doing the play-by-play for football games here in Waukesha, but also as an alderman, as we indicated, from 2019 to 2022 right here. And I want to chat a little bit about public service
sure.
in the remaining time of this hour, and then continue in the second hour, if you can stick around. We want
Please,
to chat
yeah.
more about
I'm really
that.
Really glad to be here, Jim.
And I'm delighted to have you here on a Labor Day weekend when we're focusing on people like you who have contributed so much to our community. Working hard and continuing the important work that laborers do here in America and right here in the state of Wisconsin as well. I know because we have talked about this from time to time in the past, that both as an alderman but also as a member of our Waukesha community, that you have a very special interest in Theodora Winton Yeomans. Born in 1863, died at almost 70 years old in 1932. She was a journalist. She was an editor. She was a women's suffragette activist. And has a very special connection right here in Wisconsin, including right here in Waukesha as well. And I'll do a little bit more history, and then I want to ask you about your
Sure.
interest in her and what you have committed to when it comes to that. She was the president of the Wisconsin Women's Suffragette Association. She was a part of the Waukesha Freeman right here.
A reporter, right? Yeah.
1880s. She had a column, I understand, Don, called Women's World.
Wow.
She was also involved in something called the Anti-Tuberculosis Association way back in 1908. And then, as you know, and want to follow up with you on your focus on this history, 1912 and 1917, she organized here in Wisconsin a couple of referendums that failed to establish the franchise for women. Ultimately, because of what she did here in Wisconsin throughout the nation, 19th Amendment, the Constitution's right here, 1919, it is passed, establishing the right of women to vote. Wisconsin, as you have told me, the first state in the union to ratify that. And all of that, again, not only one of Wisconsin's very proud historical figures, but also right here in Waukesha as well. Yeomans Park, right down the street from us, named after her. And I want to chat with you about the reasons why, number one, your interest in that. And number two, if I can make this a multiple question, why is it important for us to remember that and to think about what she did with Theodora Yeomans did and her lasting legacy for you and all of us?
Yeah. Well, I have Matt Flynn to thank because when he was vacationing in March, Mike Crude asked me to fill in for Matt. And so Matt Flynn direct for 1 week became a pop-up morning radio show we called Don Brown Connect, and it was focused on Waukesha. And I really wanted to add some flavor to the show and was really looking for different material to celebrate Waukesha. And I remembered, and here's why I have Mayor Sean Riley to thank, because in my first term as alderman in September of 2019, which marked the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, Mayor Riley issued a proclamation honoring Theodora. Now, is it Yeomans or Yeomans?
We'll do either one of those on right now, and I'll get my language correct, right?
But, you know, potato, potato, Theodora Yeomans or Yeomans, she's the reason Wisconsin was the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment, and just, you know, a remarkable legacy that I believe doesn't get celebrated enough here in Waukesha. And so we spent some time on Don Brown Connect last March talking about that, and then it became a part of my staple when I would announce the show, you know, coming to you live from the office of former Alderman Don Brown.
Right here.
Located in the NAMI building, so a big shout out to NAMI and the wonderful things they're doing for people and families dealing with behavioral and mental health. And so when I said right around the corner from Theodora Yeomans Park, where we're proud to honor our suffragette tradition, and so I'll play some David Bowie Suffragette City while
terrific.
I'm here, as well as today I had Wings doing Jet, you know, and
terrific.
So a little nickname. But I think it's important, the right to work, you know, as a grandson of immigrants, or the right to vote, excuse me, and the right to work, of course, but the right to vote is a very, you know, it's a right, and it's a very sacred right, and it's come under a lot of attack, I think, by many people that are misinformed or really don't understand the importance of that franchise. And a lot of blood was spilled by women, some men, but by women.
Absolutely.
To get this right to vote. And so I think we all have an obligation to those women And I'm sure, and Theodore Humans, I'm sure she endured a lot. I haven't done enough study, but I'm sure she endured a lot of physical and emotional abuse from the status quo in her efforts. And so, yeah, I think we, as Waukesha residents, have an obligation to honor that legacy and that heritage. And again, big shout out to Mayor Riley for that proclamation. And another great opportunity while being in government is you get exposed to that, a lot of the rich history here.
Absolutely. And that's one portion of it. A big important thing we recognize this weekend. We're going to chat more about that in our second hour. My good friend and colleague Don has agreed to stay with me to chat more about his time as an alderman, including history here and some recent history as well, right here in Waukesha, WAUK Radio, 101 FM, 540 AM.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. This is Jim Santel. Thank you for joining us for our second hour this morning on Labor Day weekend. It's Saturday, September 3rd, 2022. We spent the first hour or so talking about the history of Labor Day in our nation, right here in the state of Wisconsin, talking a little bit about some of the recent reporting coming out of the Federal Reserve about our economic situation today when it comes to laborers and the numbers related to both unemployment and job growth generally. And part of my second hour here continues with, from the first hour, my wonderful guest, Don Brown, who has agreed to stay with me for a little while longer in this second hour. Don, thanks so much for that. Also chatting not only about your history, your family's history, your academic history, but also your time as a worker here in America and your great service as an alderman here in the city of Waukesha. I want to get back to that in just a few moments, too. Yeah. Right before the change in the hour here, we were also talking about something that is important to you and should be to all of us, and that is the role that Theodora Yeomans played here in establishing not only the right of women to vote in the United States of America, but her presence here in Waukesha as well. She was the president of the Wisconsin League of Voters, the first one way back then, and she ran for state senate as well. She lost. She died here in Waukesha in 1932. Her legacy continues. Good for you to underscore that and continue that kind of work to make us remember history and recall the important work that people do, right? Yeah. As you said, fighting for these kinds of things.
I'm a history nerd, as you are, Jim, and I love, and history lives, and it's something that can't be forgotten. And you look at the enormous contribution of Theodora Yeomans, I guess we'll call her Yeomans, that should live, that should breathe, and that should be celebrated here. And I was telling you during the break, I've appealed or petitioned unsuccessfully to get Waukesha voters, especially women, that when they do cast their vote, to take a ride over to Theodora Yeomans Park right around the corner. And it's across from the Rotunda and just walking distance from Rochester Deli, so you could grab a sandwich. But
very good.
Go over to Yeomans Park and get a selfie right next to the sign with your I voted sticker. And I think that's a great way. And put that, blast that all over social media. You know, maybe even have some sort of event here every year that honors, you know, in September, excuse me, that honors her legacy. You know, we've got a real active Women's Executive Forum here. Our Downtown Business Association and our chamber are well represented by women. And so, as is our city government and our schools and our local businesses, a lot of women in leadership roles. And I think that's a real great opportunity to celebrate that and also raise awareness for the work that still needs to be done for greater inclusion, not just for women, but for all of us.
Right. The Yeomans Award, I understand, also granted every year by the General Federation of the Women's Club here, a citizen recognized for their specific contribution. So that legacy continues. Thank you for promoting that and making certain that we all understand that. We do have a caller, Don, who has been waiting very patiently, Dick from Madison. Thank you for calling in, Dick. Your comment, your question, time with us on this Labor Day weekend.
Well, great show as always, and fill in back in March was fun to listen to. It was really cool. Sharing one thing with you guys, how it came naturally to me, Labor Day.
Yes.
Never belonged to a union, but guess what? My grandfather was one of the founding fathers of Local 383 Iron Workers.
Nice.
Is that right?
And he worked on all kinds of historic buildings in Madison, including the Field House, both the Capitol Theater, the Orpheum Theater, you name it.
All places that continue to this day, right? Exactly.
Yeah. The last one he was on was the Coliseum.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Again, yeah. good for your family, yeah. and good to tell you us all about those kinds of things. We appreciate the history on that. Again, laborers, right? Your family making that big contribution.
If I could cut in, Jim, talk about legacy. Dick, you have something to show children, grandchildren, other family members and friends, that living legacy, those buildings that your grandfather had a hand in building.
Oh, absolutely. We got some pictures of the field house in structural steel. Looks like a big pole barn.
That's outstanding. Very good.
Pretty cool.
Absolutely. Again, as Don said, those are the kinds of things that will outlive and outlast all of us, and we'll continue with the legacies of your family, Dick, going ahead.
Yep.
And go ahead.
Have a great holiday, guys.
Very good.
Hey, too,
Dick, thanks so much for calling in. Thanks so much for calling in, Dick, and we appreciate that. Don, I want to turn to something much more somber, also a part of the history of the city of Waukesha. We recall well, November 21 of 2021, an SUV driving through the parade here, just a couple of blocks away. This major, wonderful event in Waukesha for many, many years and continuing again. Daryl Brooks Jr., he's 40 years old. He killed 6 people. Many other injuries, probably about 60 or so, including an 8-year-old boy. Member of the Dancing Grannies, others who lost their lives on that day. The legal part of this, in terms of updating, is Mr. Brooks was charged 77 charges. He is, of course, presumed innocent in our system of justice, and he has pled not guilty. He's got a trial scheduled for October 3rd. Recently, the judge who is presiding over the case, Jennifer Darrow, here in Waukesha County, denied a motion to suppress some evidence that was found in a jail cell with him. He's pled not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, and we will see how the litigation of that, how the prosecution of that plays out in court. He plainly remains in custody to this day, and not a non-controversial situation there with Mr. Brooks and a lot of fomented emotion related to that. I want to ask you, Don, not so much about the legal aspects of this, because that will be addressed by our system that we have in place for delivering the rule of law and hopefully attempting, never restoring life and restoring livelihood, but trying to provide support, not only for the direct victims, who are many, but also the victims in our community more generally. Talk with our listeners about the impact of that event in November of 2021, the lasting importance of that event in terms of who we are as a community and what kinds of lessons we can pull from that, not from the violence that was visited, but more importantly, from the notion that we are together in this. We are a community united in responding to an horrific event.
Yeah, you know, for me, Jim, it was very much, I don't know if you ever watched the series or the Philip Dick, the Man in the High Castle.
Absolutely.
But it was very much, I was in an alternative reality in the front of the parade where it was a very joyful occasion and a lot of smiling faces from a lot of different backgrounds wishing everybody Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. I was walking alongside the mayor and alderperson, Beth Wolfson, and Paul Farrell, the county executive, and his wife were in front of us. And so it was just great. And on the way back, I was walking back through the parade because that's where I was parked, and got to see some people to wave to and saw a really close friend of mine. It was him and his wife and son were in front of the courthouse. And if I'd stuck around, I probably would have been involved in the – I would have seen the atrocities. But my phone rang, and I had to take the call and decided – so I said goodbye to my friends and walked away. And it was on the way back to the house that all that happened. As I was driving past down Manhattan, past Woodman's, I got a text from my wife who's watching the live stream.
Right.
First year that I had no family members in the parade, and the first year that I myself marched in the parade, very lucky. And, you know, my heart goes out to the victims and their families. I was really pleased to see that the Plan Commission approved the Jackson Sparks Memorial complex or stadium there at William Oliver Park. I think it's a great way to celebrate that young child's
and
legacy.
Once again, to ensure that we never forget the youngster, but also what the impact of this was on all of us.
So, personal note was that two boys that I had the pleasure of coaching, I only got to coach them for two or three games in fall ball, but it was still an honor to really get to know these kids, Tyler Pudliner and Eric Teagues. Tyler was on my show with his mother back in the spring. Eric, I'd love to have back on the show. Eric lives near us, and both were good mentors to my son, Evan. It was his first year playing with older kids in baseball, and it was his first year playing fall ball. And my daughter's old softball coach was there at the parade. He's a former policeman, so he got his family out of harm's way, and then he was in first responder mode. And Eric was the first person he attended to. And he said Eric had a pulse, but he was non-responsive, like maybe in shock. And he thought that Eric was our son, Evan, because they're both tall and slender. Wow. Mm-hmm. And he texted my wife, Melissa. Evan was at a birthday party in the Dells for a good friend. Sure. And it's funny, he fought tooth and nail to allow him to go.
Right.
But there were parents there, and that's why we relented. But thank God. But just the fact that could have been Evan.
Right.
And it was a good friend of Evan's and our families. You know, his father, Don's a fire professional, just got promoted down in Caledonia. Mom, you know, just great family. And, you know, this young boy, he went from being in a wheelchair to now he's been playing baseball, everything, pitching, running, hitting. I got to announce his first game back pitching. And there was a lot of news coverage there. And Eric and his family continue to inspire us in the community, as are, you know, Tyler and some of the other survivors and the victims of their families. I know Jackson's mom is on the Parade Memorial Commission, and would love to meet her too, and some of the other family members. And City Hall has portraits of the six victims. Mm-hmm. I encourage everybody to go over there and see that. It really is a nice tribute, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what the Parade Memorial Commission is going to do with its final plan.
Yes.
And I've also been paying attention. As you know, they moved the parade to December 4th, which is
a
big...
And so this is the upside of this right now, that you cannot keep this down, right? This is about community remembering the past, but also assuring...
You mentioned the suspect because you have an obligation as a legal expert to talk about that. I choose not to focus on him.
Right.
And that was one of my conditions of having Tyler Putty, I get to call him.
Sure.
Was this, we don't want that attention to be about, because we don't want to inspire other people to do those kind of senseless acts.
Right.
We want to focus on how this community has come together and how we are Waukesha strong and how we've demonstrated that. And I couldn't be prouder to be part of this city. And I'm looking forward to finding other opportunities to continue building a more connected community.
Absolutely.
In the wake of this tragedy.
Important to do, and important, again, to remember history and learn from it. And especially, as you have said, as we've commented this morning, ensuring that I always say the victim survivors. I think that should always be a hyphenated word there, right?
Yeah,
victim
absolutely.
Survivors, because we survive even in the midst of death and tragedy.
Yeah.
And as you say, not just the reinitiation of the parade, but also other things in the community that establish that living beyond this
only
horrific
fitting
event.
Here that we're in the NAMI building that I emphasized everybody that was a witness to that tragedy to pursue what some of the options are. I know mental health is not cheap, even when it's covered, but please do your best to pursue what some of those options are for you and your family if you were witness to those tragedies, because it is like in a disease, like having the flu or having COVID.
Right.
Get the medical attention you need and deserve.
Absolutely.
And everyone deserves good mental health therapy and treatment.
Absolutely. So here in Waukesha and throughout the state of Wisconsin, throughout the nation, important message to send. I'm going to ask Don to stay with me for one more segment. We're going to chat generally about public service, his commitment to that, government, and the ways of serving our community. Stay with us as we continue our discussion with Don Brown here on Morning Cannolis, WAUK Radio, the Shaw in Waukesha. This is Jim Santel. It is Morning Cannolis. It's Saturday, September 3rd. This is a Labor Day weekend. We're spending our 2 hours together this morning talking about labor and talking about the importance of workers in America, including in that discussion my good friend and colleague Don Brown, who's remained with me for one last segment here. Thanks so much for sticking with me this morning, Don. Appreciate that tremendously.
Really,
and want to spend our last few moments here talking about public service, which has been a part of your history, your family's history, not just academically, but again recently as an alderman here in Waukesha. Talk to me about why public service is important to you.
You know, I was always really passionate about politics. One of my heroes growing up was Robert Kennedy, who was my senator for my first year of life, and was I mentioned being born in South Buffalo because Tim Russert was from there, and he was a hero of mine, and I still remember him on Father's Day every, you know, there's a weekend that he passed away. Mm-hmm. But and I believe that our national politics wouldn't be so polarized if he was still there on Meet the Press. He was a very influential, and he had such a great approach.
Right, very balanced, very thoughtful.
Very balanced, yes.
And it had a message to convey, and yet it wasn't incendiary at all. It wasn't wasn't something that prompted people to throw things at the television set, right?
Right. Just the opposite. And it was very much about common sense and reason and metrics, and I think we need to return to a little bit of that civility, no matter what your party affiliations are.
Right.
So, it is important, especially at the local level, because, and one of the advantages of being in city government here is that it's nonpartisan for the mayor and the city council, and you find really great opportunities to build bridges with people that in the national politics may be in the opposite side as you, and you find common ground, and it's, you know, neighbors care more about the quality of their garbage service and recycling service and the safety of the police, the quality of their schools.
And politics is local, as people often say, right? Government
is
local, right?
Yeah, right? And it's true. And so that's where you find common ground. And for me, that was my biggest goal, is to try to build a more connected community in my neighborhood and throughout the city. And so I would host quarterly meetings. I'd get different experts from the city government, like Mike Talaska did a great talk on trees at Banting Park one day. That was I still get great feedback on that. I believe it was Joe Hoffman, one of my guests, was on the show. He came to one of my networking events when I had it at Albanese's Roadhouse. So it all comes full circle because Joe was on the show. And people found, you know, people were meeting that built their houses around the same time in Banting Park that had never met before, because children may be of a different age group. And that connectivity is so important, starting at the street level and then going on all the way to the city. And my favorite part was handling the complaints from the neighbors, because it gave me an opportunity to engage. But then they would, I would email the person in Public Works or wherever, or Parks, or the police, whatever the situation was, and I would CC that neighbor with the contact details. And they always appreciated the quality of service, and they appreciated that they had a role. And props to the city and a lot of different departments across the board. Great leadership, great staff throughout, and very responsive. And we are very fortunate. I lived in a lot of different cities and have always been really skeptical, even cynical about local government. And then I came to Waukesha and realized that we really got a great thing going here.
It works, right?
Yeah.
Right?
No matter where I differ from the city leadership or any misgivings I have about my situation as an exile. But I've been encouraged by a lot of city leadership to stay involved and keep in touch with Mayor Riley if there's committee opportunities, or maybe even consider running again. Mm-hmm. But I love what I'm doing now with This Week in Waukesha, because I believe now I get to serve a larger constituency, and perhaps I can make an even bigger impact than I did as an alderman for what was my old first district.
Sure. So. And that 3-year period that you served as the alderman for that first district, well, I think one of the hallmarks of your time in service there was that notion that, yes, party doesn't mean, well, it means something, but does in the end doesn't mean most things. And the notion of bringing people together, sitting down across the table and recognizing that you have common challenges.
Yeah.
And there are mechanisms through that partnership you can address those issues.
And so one thing, Jim, is I've learned, too, that you can have just as much power, if not more, as Citizen Brown than maybe I ever did as Alderman Brown. Mm-hmm. And a great example is I've been lagging on this, but I have the blessings of family. I'll be organizing a memorial tree fund for Jody Walters Payne, the widow of Alderman Eric Payne and the mother of Alderman Corey Payne. Waukesha's got a great memorial tree program, and it's for only like $250 or $300, something like that. Very reasonable, and you get some neighbors each to pitch in $5 or $10, and it's a great way. But here was a person that I used to call her the Rose Kennedy of Waukesha politics, because she had, you know, two family members on the council. Right. And whenever I need to get a hold of Eric or Corey, I wouldn't call them directly. I just called Jody, and then within like five or ten minutes,
you know what works,
right? And so, but she missed very few city council meetings. Mm-hmm. She had a lot of influence the other council. She'd butt heads a lot with the mayor, and the mayor would speak.
And that's a good thing, honestly, right?
And same thing. And he, after her passing, unfortunately, around the holidays last December, the mayor at the first January did a proclamation honoring Jody Walters Payne and her citizenship. And there are many others like that. You know, and I encourage anybody, young and old, to go to a city council meeting, to give a public comment. And even if there's, don't wait for a hotbed issue that affects you and your street. Mm-hmm. Show up and see what they're talking about and see what they're planning, because citizen involvement and transparency has a huge influence on the quality of our government.
Right,
so, and I think that's another reason why we've got great services throughout.
Sure,
is the citizen involvement. And imagine if we can get more, it's just that much better. Because you, as an alderman, I got a lot of knowledge and wisdom from the neighbors who lived here a lot longer than me. That could share the history, but could share a lot of experiences that were invaluable to helping city staff continuously improve in their efforts. And if you can indulge me for a moment, I don't know much, but you remember Ralph Nader ran for president in 2000, the great consumer rights advocate and lawyer.
Yes.
A lot of the books, a lot of new laws in the books because of him. And his influence was one of his role models was his mother. And growing up in Connecticut, there was a bad flood in their hometown. And it was a recurring thing every couple of years because they weren't fixing that river. And Senator Prescott Bush, the father and grandfather of the two presidents, came. And there was a media opportunity with the press. And it was probably a soft day for, but Ralph Nader's mom reached into the crowd, reached for his hand, and in front of the cameras, held onto his hand and made him promise to deliver civil engineers here to this town and the resources of the federal government, whatever it took to fix this river and to make the dam thing go, the broken dam or whatever it was, go away, the flooding. And he had no choice because the whole world was watching.
And
kudos, you know, Senator Bush did his job.
Right.
But it was because an active citizen spoke out. And that's the gift, that's the power of real democracy, is what we have as individuals have if we choose to get involved and take up, you know, play their part. So
absolutely. Coming involved, voting, as we said at the start of our discussion, right? The Yellman's example, if you will, and beyond that. Don, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning. We'll do this again. Can we do this,
my
friend?
Yeah, please. Yeah,
my partner.
We got to have you back on 8 o'clock.
We'll do that. And thank you so much for spending this time with me, with the listeners, on this Labor Day weekend of 2022.
We're going to go have lunch or dinner at Albanese's, okay?
We'll do that.
Maybe during the 40th anniversary this month. So.
We'll do that. We shared some cannolis this morning. We'll share some food down
the
road.
Thanks again for the cannoli.
Appreciate it very much, your being with me this morning, Don. And best wishes to you, your family. We will talk again soon.
It really is my honor.
And we'll continue in this next half hour, Morning Cannolis. He's chatting about some back for the final half hour on this Saturday, September 3rd, is Labor Day weekend in America, in Wisconsin, and right here in downtown Waukesha. This is the Shaw in Waukesha, 540 AM, 101 FM. Also taking your phone calls, as always, at 844-967-2789. My name is Jim Santel. I'm joined in the studio this morning by my trusted and trusty producer, Calvin, who is also assisting me greatly this morning in bringing this broadcast to you. We're saluting labor this morning. We're talking not only about the history of Labor Day, but also the importance of it in contemporary America. Our final half hour today, I'm going to spend some time talking about some important Supreme Court cases coming out of our high court in our land, cases involving labor unions, and then also the importance of those laws under the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that ensure that employment rights are protected and safeguarded for all Americans. So lots and lots of labor cases, lots and lots of employment cases out there, generally many, many to consume and to address. This morning, just a couple of them, and I'm going to give you some history and then describe for you some of the reaction to these two very important cases. One of them is called Janus. The other one's called Bostock. Janus and Bostock. So let's begin with Janus. Let's go way back to the mid-1970s. There was a Detroit school teacher who objected to being compelled to join a teacher's union and to pay what are called agency fees to it. Dr. D. Lewis Aboud, A-B-O-O-D, at argued that by forcing him to give money to a group whose positions on various political issues differed from his own, his First Amendment right to be free from compelled speech was infringed. That was Aboud's claim. That was his litigation posture in the federal courts way back in the 1970s. And in a 1977, a landmark ruling called Aboud versus Detroit Board of Education in 1977, the United States Supreme Court disagreed with him and found that while agency fees could not be used to support lobbying or other overtly political activities, unions could. Unions could constitutionally, under the Constitution, they could require non-members to pay those sums in exchange for things like collective bargaining, workplace advocacy, anti-discrimination efforts, and other labor actions that benefit all employees, whether they're union members or not. Very, very significant case, 1977, Abood. As Associate Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan would write some 4 decades later, our decisions have long afforded government entities broad latitude to manage their workforces, even when that affects speech that they could not regulate in other contexts. That's Elena Kagan recently writing about the impact of Abood way back in 1977. And that was the law. That was the law until 2018. That recent restatement in Abood of the judicial and labor history in our nation appears again in the Supreme Court history as they readdressed this issue. And this case is decided in the summer of 2018, about 4 years or so ago. The case is called Janus versus American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, 2018. And in that particular case, or again, writing on behalf of majority, Supreme Court Justice, Associate Justice Sam Alito, whose name you recall because he was also the author of the recent decision in Dobbs overruling Roe versus Wade, Justice Alito said 4 years ago this. He concluded in this way, a like attack on this obligation to pay union fees, union dues, agency fees. He said this. Developments since Abood was handed down have shed new light on the issue of agency fees, and no reliance interests on the part of public sector unions are sufficient to justify the perpetuation of the free speech violations that Abood has countenanced for the past 41 years. Now, that's a lot. That's a lot of language right there. Lots of words going on there. Basically, what he was saying was Abood is no longer good law. We have reconsidered this, and we can no longer support that notion that political activities, those kinds of things, while they could not be used for those political activities, lobbying, unions could, in fact, require non-members to pay sums for things like, again, workplace advocacy, anti-discrimination efforts, collective bargaining. Abood is overruled in this case called Janus. 49 pages at that time. The Chief Justice, Chief Justice Roberts, Associate Justices Gorsuch, Kennedy, and Thomas concurred. And the United States Supreme Court, agreeing with Mark Janus, a child support specialist, he was employed at the time by the Illinois Department of Health Care and Family Services, who had refused at that time to join the employees' union based on his opposition to many of the public policy positions that union advocated, including its worker advocacy and wage bargaining. So the Supreme Court in Janus overruling Abood, which had been the law of the land for about 40 years, this major, major labor case that, again, affected dramatically not only the past history of labor unions and their capacity to receive union dues from members and non-members, now reversed by the United States Supreme Court in 2018. The president of AFSCME at that time wrote this in response to this decision in late June of 2018. He said this, the Supreme Court's decision makes little effort to hide the court majority's hostility to the idea that workers should have the freedom to bargain with their employers. The challenge, the president went on to say, this is the president of AFSCME, the challenge now is to construct policies consistent with the court's decision while still fostering state policies promoting collective bargaining and labor organizations. The only way, he went on to say, to preserve a vibrant union is for workers to want it, to work for it, and to pay for it. That, again, the head of the AFSCME at that time responding to this decision in Janus overruling Abood. We know that those kinds of things that the president of AFSCME was talking about are in support of our country's 117 million private sector and 21 million public sector workers. We celebrate them all this weekend. They established, as a result of the labor movement, things like occupational safety and military leave and merit-based compensation, privacy rights, overtime pay, unemployment insurance, family medical leave, and yes, that's right, weekends and lunch breaks. All those things as a result of the labor movement here in the United States of America begun way back in the late 19th century, as we talked at the start of our first hour this morning. Among many other landscape-changing achievements, the labor movement in America partner with other groups and individuals who are likewise committed to things like fairness and dignity in all aspects of contemporary life. The labor union responsible for things called like the Equal Pay Act of 1963 and, again, another version of that in 2011. Labor responsible for the Age Discrimination in Employment Act of 1967, the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970, and, yes, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That, as you well know, prohibiting, among other things like discrimination in the workplace based upon race and color, national origin, religion, gender, sexual orientation, and gender identity. All those kinds of things coming out of the labor movement and the important role that workers have played in America, not only in ensuring that our country is strong and safe and secure, but that our laws reflect those kinds of things, even the decisions in the Supreme Court. And this commitment, even beyond cases like Janus that overruled Abood, finding some ways forward to address those issues as we go forward. In the wake of those and some other post-Janus initiatives, all rightly schooled, if you will, by Justice Kagan, who again writes in dissent in Janus. She says this, that's a fiery description of where we've been and where we are today. She says, Abood is not just any precedent, although it's now gone. It is embedded in the law in a way not many decisions are. Over four decades, Justice Kagan wrote, this court, the Supreme Court, has affirmed and applied its central distinction between the costs of collective bargaining and those of political activities. She went on to say, reviewing those decisions not a decade ago, this court unanimously called the Abood rule a general First Amendment principle. And maybe most alarmingly, the majority of the Supreme Court has chosen the winners by turning the First Amendment into a sword and using it against workaday economic and regular policy. She would finally said, speech is everywhere, a part of every human activity, including those in the labor force, the labor movement in America. The First Amendment meant for better things. That is Justice Elena Kagan in dissent in this major case in Janus. In our final moments together this morning, I'm going to talk about another major case called Bostock involving discrimination rights, also coming out of the United States Supreme Court. Join me for that last portion of our time together this morning as we celebrate labor and workers in America. For the final moments this morning on Morning Cannolis, we're saluting labor this morning. All morning, we've talked about the history. We've talked about the role of public servants, both inside government and outside government, with my good friend and colleague, Don Brown. And now we're spending some time in the last few moments chatting about a couple of major Supreme Court cases, one having to do with labor unions and their capacity to receive from non-union and their own members fees and agency fees in support of their work. And then a second case, which I'm going to chat about now, called Bostock. Before we get to that, we do have a caller on the line. Mark from Perry Dusac. We're glad to have you with us this morning. Mark, your comment or question on this Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, that decision is kind of disturbing. As someone who was, I was actually a steward in the Wisconsin Professionals Employees Council, one of the state employees unions that was eviscerated by Scott Walker during Act 10, that the whole nonsense that, oh, the unions were also all-powerful and all this. Well, we were bargaining with the state. And, it always amused me that some of the people who didn't pay the full dues membership, that they're some of the first ones. If they got into trouble, they were there to turn to the union for representation. If they were, due for discipline, or that if they thought their rights as an employee were violated, they were, some of the first ones to actually ask for assistance. Yet some of these people don't feel it's necessary to pay the dues. I mean, yes, you disagree with some of the political positions the union takes, but you could opt, in our union, and I think for the state employees unions, you could opt out of that portion of the union dues that was determined to be used for political purposes. You only had to pay for the actual operation of the union itself, performing employee services.
Sure. Right. And that was Abood, right? That was the parameters of Abood for 41 years, and then Janus comes along, as you appropriately say, Mark, and changes the landscape dramatically. The point that you make about this disparate access to the benefits of labor unions by people who are paying and not paying, that was also part of the discussion inside of Janus, and obviously the Supreme Court went in the other direction, much to the chagrin and the outrage of folks like you and of Supreme Court justices like Elena Kagan. So appreciate that comment, Mark. As always, thank you for calling in. I'm going to spend the last few moments now chatting about another case. Again, many, many cases out there in connection with labor and employment and discrimination in particular. Let's talk about a case called Gerald Bostock, Bostock. All these cases, like Janus, like Abood, they all derive from human beings, right? As Mark was just indicating, his own experiences. This, too, comes out of a story of Gerald Bostock for 10 years. Beginning in 2003, Mr. Bostock was employed with very high reviews by Clayton County, Georgia. He was a juvenile court official. He was responsible for many, many things, ensuring legal representation, other support for minors involved in various court-related transactions and proceedings. In 2003, Gerald Bostock joined a gay softball league and promoted that publicly as a community volunteer in that league. In April of that year, the county fired Bostock, allegedly on the basis that he had mishandled some government funds, which plainly does not play out and pan out in the course of the litigation itself. Believing that claim, which he denied, any sort of improper management of funds, believing that was a pretense for terminating his employment, Gerald Bostock, because he was gay, that was his theory, that he was terminated not because of some inappropriate handling, but because of his sexual identity, his sexual orientation at that time. And Bostock, like others, sought the protection of the federal civil rights laws, this thing called the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We've made mention of it already in this broadcast and others. He invoked its prohibitions on discrimination in employment on the basis of sex. That word appears explicitly in Title 7 of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And that his principal legal argument, that is that Title VII precludes job-related actions based on sexual orientation, that was rejected by both the federal trial and appellate courts, leading ultimately to a successful appeal to the United States Supreme Court, bringing this issue, along with other cases involving a fellow named Donald Zarda, a woman named Amy Stevens, all of those consolidated to address the issue of what sex means, what that word means. We talked before about language. What does sex mean? How broad is it? What is the protection under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964? And in a consolidated landmark decision of just a couple of years ago, Justice Neil Gorsuch, writing for a 6-3 majority at that time, explains that indeed there is coverage, that the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 does ensure that people like Gerald Bostock and Donald Zarda and Amy Stevens and others in this nation who may find themselves discriminated against based upon sexual orientation or gender identity are protected under the employment laws of this nation. Neil Gorsuch writes this. It says, those who adopted the Civil Rights Act might not have anticipated their work would lead to this particular result, but it does. He writes in particular this. He says that an employer who fired an individual for being homosexual or transgendered fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex. It's a lot to consume. Let me read that again. This is what Neil Gorsuch said in finding a broad and appropriate application of Title 7. He says, an employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgendered fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex. In other words, identifying the disparate treatment, the difference in treatment between people who should be treated the same. Justice Gorsuch, again, writing for the 6-3 majority, went on to say, sex plays a necessary and indistinguishable role in the decision, exactly what Title VII forbids. Those who adopted the Civil Rights Act might not have anticipated their work, as I was just indicating, that would lead to this particular result, but the limits of the drafter's imagination supply no reason to ignore the law's demands. Only the written word, Justice Gorsuch goes on to say, is the law, and all persons are entitled to its benefit. Dramatic, important language. Only the written word is the law, and all persons are entitled to its benefit. A major case in labor law, in discrimination law. Just a couple of years ago, Justice Gorsuch's decision, again writing on behalf of the majority at that time, also alludes to the concerns that the judgment may set a sweeping precedent that would force gender equality on traditional practices. He anticipates some of the arguments that were in fact made by Justice Alito in dissent. And Justice Gorsuch, in anticipation of that, says this. They say sex-segregated bathrooms and locker rooms and dress codes will prove unsustainable after our decision today, but none of those laws are here before us today. We have not had the benefit of adversarial testing about the meaning of their terms, and we do not prejudge any such questions today. In other words, Today we're announcing, as he did back in 2020, this fundamental notion that Title VII, when it makes reference to sex and prohibits discrimination based upon that immutable characteristic of sexual orientation and gender identity, it protects people of the LGBTQIA community and beyond. And the fact that this may have implications down the road, well, those cases are not in front of us today. They may well be at some point down the road, but they're not in front of us today. And indeed, the Supreme Court is going to be wrestling with these issues, as will other lower courts in the years to come. There is a case coming up in the next term of the United States Supreme Court, coming out of Colorado, that addresses, again, the role and the responsibilities of government and of all people when it comes to LGBT rights and prerogatives having to do with a discriminatory practice of a particular wedding planner out in Colorado. We'll chat about that more in a future show. Those kinds of things, the kinds of things that Justice Gorsuch predicted would be before the Supreme Court, they're happening. They're going to show up on the docket in the future. But to this day, and this wonderful recodification, if you will, of the broad scope and ambit of the Civil Rights Act in June of 2020 stands to this day. Not surprisingly, Sam Alito wrote a dissent. He was joined by Justice Clarence Thomas, and in that dissent, Alito asserted that at the time of the crafting of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the concepts of sexual orientation and gender identity would have been unknown. And so Justice Alito said Congress's language should not be implied to cover those facts. He wrote this specifically. Many will applaud today's decision because they agree on policy grounds with the court's updating of Title VII. But the question, Alito says, in these cases is not whether discrimination because of sexual orientation or gender identity should be outlawed. The question, he says, is whether Congress did that in 1964. Alito and others conclude it indisputably did not, and goes on to say that even if discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity could be squeezed into some arcane understanding of sexual discrimination, the context in which Title VII was enacted would tell us that this is not what the statute's terms were understood to mean at that time, and goes on to criticize Justice Gorsuch and the majority for the decision. Why is this important? Why am I talking about this today on Labor Day weekend, on a day when we celebrate the importance of labor? because it ensures that the tent is broad, right? That Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that does make these broad prohibitions to ensure that employment practices based on individuals' race, color, religion, national origin, and sex include everyone in America with those immutable characteristics, that has not limited the kinds of things that Justice Alito described in his narrow, and I would offer, not forward-looking dissent in that case. We applaud today, as we do these other cases coming out of the Supreme Court and lower courts, that support the notion the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was a part of our civil rights trajectory here in the United States of America, and we celebrate that this morning on Morning Cannolis. I thank you as we conclude our time together this morning for joining me for this celebration of labor and of employment here in America. I'd like to thank Mike Crute as well for giving this opportunity. This is our 12th program. I'd like to thank Calvin and Connor, my producers in the past, everybody here at WAUK for listening in. Thank you to Don Brown today for joining us. Thank you for listening in today. Join us again next week for more Morning Cannolis as we once again review